Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, a few months ago it seemed like Dick Cheney wouldn't get off your television screen, insisting that secret CIA documents would prove that Bush torture policies saved the United States from further terrorist attacks. Well, those documents have surfaced, along with a 2004 CIA Inspector General's report. So has Cheney been vindicated? We'll speak with reporter Spencer Ackerman of The Washington Independent about that. Also on the show, outrageous and disgusting is how White House spokesperson Robert Gibbs described scenes in Tripoli where Abdel al-Megrahi was greeted on his recent return. Megrahi was convicted in 2001 of bombing Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. His release from prison on medical grounds has provoked some anger and questioning in the press. But these were elements remarkably absent at the time of his trial. We'll talk with veteran media critic and author Edward Herman about what's gone down the media's memory hole on the Lockerbie story. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
If you're a government official, it makes sense that you would try to reverse a trend of declining public support for a war you're engaged in by, among other things, going on TV. But if you're a TV news program, is it your job to let yourself be used that way? Or should you respond to polls showing declining public support for a war by including that critical perspective in your programs, perhaps seeking explanations for it? The Sunday morning talk shows gave their answer this past weekend. On the heels of a mid-August ABC Washington Post poll showing 51% of respondents believe the war in Afghanistan is not worth fighting, that's the first time that position has received majority support, with just 24% supporting sending more troops, ABC's This Week, CNN's State of the Union, and NBC's Meet the Press all featured war boosters, including some Pentagon officials, to talk up the war effort. CNN billed their segment as a debate about whether to send more troops. But someone forgot to tell the participants who didn't actually disagree about it. And ABC's George Stephanopoulos noted the public's disapproval in an interview with John McCain, which was headlined on ABC's website, "McCain, Obama Doing What I Would Do on Battlefields." But the host asked the senator, quote, "What do we need to see in 12 to 18 months to make sure the public and the Congress stay behind this war?" Close quote. Which certainly sounds like he thinks the aim is to shape public opinion to conform to the policy, rather than considering whether the policy should change in response to public opinion. The only forceful criticism of war escalation came from ABC's George Will, who said, quote, "I think the American people are right about this," close quote. Too bad he's the same guy who says there can't be global warming if it's cold out.
Embedding reporters with U.S. military forces is troubling enough on its own. But according to the military paper Stars and Stripes, these arrangements are even worse than we think. On August 24th, the paper revealed that potential embeds in Afghanistan were being screened by the controversial D.C. PR firm, the Rendon Group, who were assessing reporters' previous coverage of the military and helping to determine whether certain reporters should be approved for embedding. Rendon was grading reporters on a positive, neutral, negative scale, though military officials insisted that they would not deny a reporter an embed slot because that journalist's coverage was deemed too critical. As Stars and Stripes pointed out, though, that was precisely what happened to one of their own reporters. After the Pentagon issued denials that this rating system existed, Stars and Stripes followed up with a story on August 27th, where they posted one of the Rendon-generated ratings of a reporter's work. The Rendon profiles also include suggestions about how best to influence the journalist's coverage, something that directly contradicts the Pentagon's own rules for embedding, according to Stars and Stripes. Oh, and if you're still trying to remember why the name the Rendon Group sounds so familiar, they were instrumental in setting up the Iraqi National Congress, the defectors group responsible for feeding WMD disinformation to the press. Good to see they're still getting government work.
U.S. State Department official Judith McHale recently visited Pakistan, and while there, she met with a Pakistani journalist who expressed anger about civilian casualties there as the result of U.S. missile and drone attacks. It's not hard to imagine that someone would feel that way, so it was interesting to see a New York Times account of the visit on August 20th. As the Times patiently explained, our government makes its case with, quote, "points that to many Americans would appear logical, but that often fail to impress over here. Al-Qaeda and Mr. bin Laden attacked attacked the United States on September 11, 2001. The war in Afghanistan, unlike the war in Iraq, is blessed by the United Nations and is a multinational effort. America will always do whatever it takes to defend itself. Close quote. While it's a stretch to assume that one can speak for Americans' grasp of logic, what reporter Helena Cooper is really saying is that this makes sense to her, that because the United States was attacked 8 years ago and a NATO invasion of Afghanistan was authorized, and that the United States is a superpower, all of that makes the deaths of hundreds of civilians in Pakistan, well, logical. To attribute this view to the American public seems unfair at the very least. It seems more likely that this sort of worldview belongs to U.S. elites and to elite reporters.
Well, it's no mystery that corporate media use deficits as boogeymen because they just don't like social spending. Things like housing and transportation and health care just don't excite elite journalists in the way that, say, tax cuts do, or even other sorts of spending, say, on invasion and war. But as the saying goes, these outlets may be entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. The Washington Post breaks that rule with their August 26th page one piece headlined, "Deficit Projected to Soar with New Programs," and helpfully subheadlined, 10-year estimate of $9 trillion fuels critics of president's agenda. The problem, as economist Dean Baker pointed out in his Beat the Press blog, is that the main cause of the increase in the deficit in the latest projections is not new programs. The main cause of the increase is worse than expected unemployment and growth numbers. Says Baker, a more neutral account of the projections would have highlighted the fact that the Congressional Budget Office now expects the unemployment rate to average 10.2% in 2010, while it previously had projected that unemployment would average just 9%. But readers won't find that information until deep into the Post's piece, past the jump. The Post also claims that deficits of the size projected, quote, would require dramatically more government borrowing from China and other creditors, close quote. But Baker reminds us that it's the trade deficit that requires borrowing from China, not the budget deficit. Whatever one thinks of U.S. economic policy, such fudging of facts just shouldn't pass muster for a newspaper, even if this piece had been on the editorial page where it belonged.
And finally, 18-year-old South African runner Caster Semenya blew away the competition in the women's 800-meter world championship race. But the news reports weren't just about that. They were about whether she's really a woman or not. And supposedly serious outlets like the AP and CNN sank to tabloid levels on the issue. An August 20th AP video of the controversy that was posted on the LA Times website kicks off with this, quote, "Quick! Man or woman," close quote. The piece includes slow pans over Semenya's body, along with more tabloidy commentary like, "She," and "Yes, she," claims to be a woman. And it offers a clip of her voice as some sort of evidence of something. It's what you'd expect to find on the E! Channel, not the AP or the LA Times website, for that matter. CNN's Jack Cafferty's response to the news was, quote, "Story creeps me out. It's weird. Do you think she's a man or a woman?" close quote. His colleague Campbell Brown teased the bizarro story on August 20th and promised viewers more on this very strange case, while CNN's Anderson Cooper and Erica Hill called it fascinating, amazing, and wild. During her story on the subject, CNN's Brown acknowledged one of the problems with the scrutiny, quote, "I mean, this is a young woman, a young girl. It's a pretty cruel thing for this girl to have to go through emotionally, psychologically, presuming it's not a scam," close quote. Yes, indeed, scrutinizing someone's body and gender presentation on television and calling them bizarre and creepy is pretty cruel, as well as unprofessional. Unfortunately, that sort of coverage of people with different gender presentations is not unusual, and awareness of that cruelty didn't stop Campbell Brown from feeding into it.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
A few months back, it seemed like you couldn't get away from Dick Cheney even if you tried. Everywhere you turned, it seemed, the former vice president was making the case that secret CIA memos would prove that the Bush administration's torture policies worked. This served to shift the debate over torture from one of legality to one of efficacy, and it left Cheney daring the Obama administration to release these memos that would apparently settle all this once and for all in his favor. Well, this week, those CIA documents were made public, along with a 2004 more CIA Inspector General's report. Joining us now to talk about what's in these reports and what we can say now about Cheney's defense is Spencer Ackerman, a reporter for the Washington Independent, who's been plowing through all these documents. Spencer Ackerman, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, this story can get a little complicated. These two CIA memos were released at the same time as this bigger report. But let's stick to the memos and to that argument Dick Cheney was advancing. Keeping it very simple, is there something here that says what Cheney told us would be here?
Well, remember, when Cheney went on Sean Hannity's show and also when he made a speech in May to the American Enterprise Institute, he said that documents that he had seen and the CIA had prepared would show that the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques had resulted in intelligence that saved lives, prevented attacks, and demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that they worked. And this, as you mentioned, got a tremendous amount of media attention. You'll remember that when President Obama made his speech to the National Archives on national security, the networks played up Cheney's speech as a kind of institutional response.
Mm-hmm.
And now these documents have been declassified, and it paints a much more murky and equivocal picture than Cheney presented. It's too pat to say that they demonstrate that the techniques didn't work, but they don't make the case that Cheney presented. And a lot of what these documents say, it's one document from 2004 and another from 2005, talking about how information from detainees who at certain points were subjected to the interrogation techniques resulted in intelligence. And as well, it resulted in intelligence that was largely historical in nature. You have to combine this with the CIA Inspector General's report from 2004 that was released on Monday as well, saying that it's extremely difficult to judge these techniques' effectiveness and that there was no evidence that he could determine that any of the plots discussed when the detainees were subjected to these techniques were imminent. It doesn't say much beyond that, and there's a lot of redactions, but ultimately, the case that Cheney presented was not supported as he presented it to the public several months ago.
Now, the documents are murky enough. Some of the media discussion makes things worse. It seems like there was an LA Times headline that said that CIA interrogation memos provide fodder for both sides, which, of course, is true, but doesn't tell you much about what's actually in the memos. There was a reporter from CBS, Bob Orr, that declared that the documents do support the claims of former Vice President Dick Cheney that harsh interrogations at times did work, which, again, it seems loaded with caveats. You wrote one piece that suggested you could see how the right wing was going to make this Cheney was right argument. People like Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard are doing that. No surprises. What kind of argument are they making, and where does it sort of fall apart, do you think?
Well, there is an argument that depends a lot on conflating the difference between saying the documents show that valuable interrogation came from detainees in the program and then saying that it came from the enhanced interrogation techniques themselves. And a tremendous amount of what's in the CIA Inspector General's report is, I guess I would say, scrupulously fair and diligent in trying to apply skepticism and calm, dispassion, and that sort of analysis to these claims, and never, at least in the unredacted versions that we have, does the Inspector General say definitively this worked or this didn't work? There are numbers of caveats in the section of the report on effectiveness that talk about the indeterminacy of answering that question. And when you can sort of skip around as, you know, you would like and cherry pick, you can come up with an argument that says this program generated intelligence because we know the detainees generated intelligence. And that's a conflation that has served the former vice president's purposes.
I guess the message that I got from looking at some of them was that torture was happening alongside conventional interrogations. So really to say that torture was the thing that produced the good intelligence, or whether or not it was good intelligence or not, is something that's kind of unanswered in the memos. It does make sense to ask whether the outlets that gave Cheney these platforms to make his case are going to offer similar time to explaining how his argument is now jeopardized and how it's fallen apart. But putting aside Dick Cheney for a moment, you've gone through these documents, especially this Inspector General's report you've been writing about interrogation policy and torture. Has anything you've seen struck you as either entirely new or uniquely troubling that you didn't see before? What's in here for reporters to dig into if they want to do something other than, say, the kind of back and forth between people on Dick Cheney's side and the White House?
One of the most remarkable disclosures in this report is not just some of the real lurid stuff that was done, you know, the blowing smoke in a detainee's face. Everyone's now heard about the interrogator who brought a gun into an interrogation and so forth. But the systemic nature of it has been rather striking, and particularly there is an interrogation technique that before we didn't really know about, and that's something called prolonged diapering, whereby, according to annexes in the CIA Inspector General's report from former Director George Tenet and from the CIA's Office of Medical Service, we now know that an interrogation technique was allowed for the enhanced interrogation program whereby a detainee was put in diapers for an indeterminate period of time. And one of the more alarming things about that is that there was a standard interrogation technique, a distinction that Tenet drew in these notes for interrogators called his guidelines from January of 2003, distinguishing basically the enhanced interrogation technique of diapering from the standard interrogation technique of diapering, which was supposed to be done for 72 hours. And think about that for a moment. You're putting an adult in a diaper for 3 days, and that's the standard version of it. I went back and checked a report that Mark Danner at the New York Review of Books broke that the International Committee of the Red Cross compiled after interviewing the detainees who had come through the CIA's program, and it makes numerous references to detainees describing being shackled in uncomfortable stress positions for days on end, being unable to sleep because of this. And this was a revelation from the last round of disclosures about sleep deprivation being accomplished through stress positions. And then they add references to how they were put in diapers for long periods of time, forced to urinate and defecate on themselves. And this is something that really hasn't come into the public sphere before. There had been these, you know, mentions in the Red Cross report and in some previous documents that the Obama administration disclosed from the Justice Department earlier this year, but without the context of knowing that diapering was an interrogation technique itself, let alone an enhanced interrogation technique, it was difficult to contextualize that. And that's something that really deserves a lot more scrutiny. It's unclear where, in fact, the legal rationale for prolonged diapering comes from. There's a reference early in the CIA IG's report to the fact that when the initial round of interrogation techniques for the enhanced interrogation program was being sent to the Justice Department, one of those techniques, and it's redacted which one, was basically stripped away because the Justice Department said it would just take too much time to figure out how to construct a legal analysis that would exonerate the agency in using this technique. So figuring out the genesis legally is something we've just simply not been able to see yet.
We've been speaking with Spencer Ackerman. He's a reporter for the Washington Independent. You can read his work on their website, washingtonindependent.com. Spencer Ackerman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
The New York Times and others are raising questions about whether lucrative oil contracts may have played a role in Scotland's release, ostensibly on compassionate grounds, of Abdel al-Megrahi, the man convicted of the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie. Journalistic skepticism about official explanations is well and good, but you can't call something a principle unless it's consistently applied, and that's just not the case when it comes to U.S. reporting on Lockerbie. Myriad serious questions that attended the Lockerbie case, from the investigation of the crash site itself to deeply troubling aspects of the trial to the very relevant political context, seem erased or distorted now. by a press corps that largely failed to ask them the first time around. Joining us to discuss the story is veteran media critic Edward Herman. He's professor emeritus of finance at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, author and co-author of many books, including Manufacturing Consent and the Political Economy of Human Rights. Ed Herman also contributes a regular column to Z Magazine and edits a website, inkywatch.org, that monitors the Philadelphia Inquirer. He joins us now by phone from the Philadelphia area. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ed Herman.
Glad to be with you, Janine.
Well, much is being made right now in the media of the way in which Megrahi was received on returning to Libya. We heard the White House spokesperson Robert Gibbs call the welcomes outrageous and disgusting. You wrote in 2001 of the hero's welcome given another military officer, one who we know actually did shoot down a civilian airliner. I wonder if you could tell us that story and the relevance of it.
There was an Iranian airliner shot down 5.5 months before Pan Am 103 was shot down. It was shot down by a U.S. naval boat, Vincennes, which was in fact protecting Saddam Hussein in near Iran at that time. And it shot down this Iranian airliner, killing 290 people. And the captain of this ship, who was noted to be a Rambo type, and who by other naval officers was condemned for shooting down this plane and for his other actions, when he came home to San Diego several months later, he was actually greeted as a hero. And the New York Times even had a little back page article showing him with flower scarf around his neck and smiling. And as a matter of fact, the American public in opinion polls thought well of him because the media had not treated this as a case of terrorism or anything particularly bad. Anyway, the Iranian certainly did not like this very much. And so here we have a very analogous situation. A guy, in fact, it's not that analogous because the question of whether Megrahi actually did it is not completely accepted business. He was convicted, but a lot of people who know a lot think that this was a fraudulent trial. But there's no question but that Captain Roger shot down a plane, killing 290 civilians, and he was celebrated for it. So you had this wonderful dichotomy. Here the Libyans are greeting a man who they believe, and I believe, didn't do any killing. And the man who did kill 290 people is greeted as a hero in the United States. And this is treated very benignly.
Besides showcasing the flexible standards of the media on what is terrorism and what isn't, there's, of course, a direct connection between the shootdown of Iranian airliner 655 in July of 1988 and the subsequent shooting down of Pan Am 103. Many people thought, in fact, the one was a retaliation for the other initially. Isn't that true?
Oh, it's very true. It actually was the U.S. and British party line for many months. As soon as Pan Am 103 was shot down, suspicion was immediately on the part of officials that this was an Iranian act of vengeance. And there, in fact, there was a fair amount of information pointing in that direction. There was a claim that they had hired a terroristic group in Germany to do it. In fact, one of the suppressed documents in the trial was a document that quotes the CIA, September 24th, 89, the bombing of the Pan Am flight was conceived, authorized, and financed by Al-Akbar Mokhtashmimi, Iran's former interior minister. The execution of the operation was contracted to Ahmad Jibril, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, for a sum of $1 million. This is a CIA document of 1989 that was not introduced during the trial. The politicization of this trial is really quite remarkable. Initially, it was thought to be an Iran-arranged terrorist act. Then we became concerned about hostages in Lebanon, who Syria had some connection with, and we were going to war with Saddam Hussein, so Iran became concerned about it. So all of a sudden, we shifted from Iran and this front group in West Germany to Libya. This shift, I mean, it certainly should arouse the media's consideration. It should make them a little bit suspicious.
Well, one of the reasons that that switch in supposed perpetrator from first an understanding that it was Iran with this Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and Syria involvement to suddenly it's Libya, part of the reason we're not talking about it is that media are completely erasing it. A recent Chicago Tribune question and answer asked who was responsible for the bombing, and the answer was, quote, suspicion immediately focused on revolutionary Libya, seen by the West as a leading state sponsor of terrorism, close quote. That's simply not true.
Exactly. The interesting thing is they swallowed the Iran PFLP connection. They swallowed it initially, and then when the party line changed, they swallowed the new party line, and they did it very aggressively. Some people have argued very coherently that this made a fair trial very difficult.
Finally, and speaking of swallowing the official line, I'm wondering your thoughts about the current coverage. What specifically about the release, for example? Do you think there is really any reason to question the compassionate grounds offered for the release of Megrahi?
Yes, I do. I think the Scottish authorities were very worried that if he wasn't released, he was going to pursue the further disclosure of the truth. And that would be awkward. In fact, one thing suppressed in the American media is that a Scottish legislator named Christine Graham has actually proposed that the prosecutor of Megrahi be himself prosecuted for suppressing information like those CIA documents. One of the few substantive things in the New York Times coverage was the admission toward the end of the article that a trial judge, one of the Scottish trial judges, had said that they were under an intense pressure to convict. Now, an honest newspaper, you know, would feature that and would use that to look more closely at the whole business. If the judges were under this kind of pressure to convict, what kind of trial was it? Was this really a fair trial? Maybe we ought to look closer.
We've been speaking with professor and author Edward Herman. His column Fog Watch appears regularly in Z Magazine, and his monitoring of the Philadelphia Inquirer is inkywatch.org. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.